This is Carlin on 98.7 ESPN.
What is going on, everybody? Dan Grasso in for Chris here on this Tuesday, 13th day of July, All-Star Night 2021. 800-919-ESPN is our telephone number, 800-919-3776. We're taking it right up until the Midsummer Classic out at Coors Field. That'll be right at 8 o'clock this evening. Get the ESPN radio broadcast. The guys do an outstanding job. And an All-Star game that we didn't have last year. And, you know, when you've seen all the pageantry over the last couple of days, you realize, you know, it's certainly something that we missed. We missed a lot of things. Missed out on a lot of things, certainly, over the last year and a half. And the All-Star game is no different. Remember, last year's game was supposed to be at Dodger Stadium in L.A. That got moved to next year. So you're going to have back-to-back West Coast All-Star games here with baseball. Dodger Stadium next year, and, of course, Colorado and Coors Field here once again this evening. And don't forget, as always, you can get me on Twitter, at Dan Graca, G-R-A-C-A, as we take it right up until 8 o'clock and the first pitch of the All-Star game. And, you know, last night we talked a lot about the home run derby, where you had a little bit of local flair, a little bit of local representation, of course, with Pete Alonso of the New York Mets going in to try to, you know, defend his title from a couple of years ago in Cleveland. And lo and behold, he was able to do it. And he put on a show, and he certainly played to the crowd, and he was having a good time, which was the most important thing. Because at the end of the day, you got to remember, home run derby, it's an exhibition, it's for the fans, it's for people at home, you know, the baseball fan that needs something to watch when you don't really have any other sports going on, certainly at this time of year, everything is pretty much shut down. And he went out there and he did kind of what he did 2 years ago. And in that ballpark, where the air is thin and the ball travels, I mean, it is tailor-made for a guy like Pete Alonso to be smoking balls 500 feet out of the ballpark. And that's what he did. I mean, line drive shots, which got out of here in a matter of seconds. And he really just took advantage and seized the moment. And look, I know that he's not an all-star this year in terms of a player, but I think that, you know, the more you think about it, the fact that he came back and decided to enter this exhibition, which is what it was, you know, wanting to defend his title, wanting to go out there and put on a good show and maybe be a representative of Major League Baseball, that was cool to see, you know. And the fact that the guy gets it and the fact that the guy enjoys what he's doing out there, I think that's certainly a nice reflection on some of the young stars here in this game, that they're not too big to do these type of things. And, you know, some of them can't be bothered. And I know it's gotten a lot of talk, certainly, over the last week about guys that opted out of this All-Star game and didn't even want to make the flight out there to Coors Field. So good for Pete, and good that he put on a show. And the best part about the whole thing, which is something that I talked about last night and I cautioned against, and you kept your fingers crossed and you hoped that nothing would go wrong in terms of injuries, and that he wouldn't go out there and pull an oblique or throw his back out or injure his shoulder or something like that. Everything checked out A-okay. I mean, we haven't heard anything yet, so we would think that it's all systems go for Pete. But he went out there, hit 74 home runs total. He's your home run derby champion. And, you know, good for him, really. And, you know, when you think about it, this is a guy who still, because, you know, he's still on his, you know, first contract here, if you will, as a Major League Baseball player. He hasn't gone to arbitration yet. He's only in his second full season as a big leaguer. I guess if you count last year, too. So, you know, maybe his third. But he's still pretty much making, like, minimum salary for a big leaguer, which is nothing to sneeze at. It's somewhere around the, you know, $500,000 ballpark, somewhere around there. So he hasn't really cashed in yet and made the big, crazy, ridiculous money like some of these other players have done, the more established stars in baseball. Nobody, you know, the Mets haven't bought out his arbitration years and given him a team-friendly, like, six-year deal to kind of cover those free agency seasons or anything like that. So even winning a home run derby like this for Pete, which is, I think, like $1 million or somewhere in that neighborhood, I mean, he's, you know, adding a little bit to his piggy bank there, and he's entitled to. I know that last time when he won it, he made a nice donation to charity. I think it was something along the lines of, you know, the Wounded Warriors or servicemen and women, something like that, the veterans. And I don't know if he's going to do the same here this time around. He's not obligated to in any way, shape, or form. But, yeah, I guess there is a little bit of a financial incentive there for somebody like Pete to go out there and be in this home run derby, win it, and, you know, he stole the show. He did, and he's a back-to-back home run derby champion. He joins Ken Griffey Jr., who did it, our old pal Yoenis Cespedes, who did it as well. And by the way, did you see that article in the Post today from Ken Davidoff, an exclusive, that earlier this season when the Mets were going through their issues with the injuries and they were missing guys left and right, that they actually reached out to Yoenis Cespedes' camp to see if he would be interested in maybe coming back and being part of the mix all over again. But I guess Cespedes declined because the Mets weren't willing to guarantee him a major league roster spot. You know, you have to go down to the minor leagues and earn it. And I guess there were some other teams that were kicking the tires on Cespedes as well. But, you know, he fashioned himself a little bit more important and a little bit more established and didn't want to go that route. And, you know, look, who's to say he's ever going to step foot on a big league field again if that's what he has in his mind? Maybe he'll get a chance, maybe he won't. But and I found that interesting that the Mets would even go down that direction. Like, when I think of Cespedes, and look, he served his purpose when he was here. Everybody's going to remember what he did in 2015. And, you know, when they have, you know, the reunion of the 2015 National League champion Mets, and if Cespedes shows up and if he comes out riding a horse and, you know, they give him a standing ovation, because Mets don't get to the World Series in 2015 without Yoenis Cespedes. So I think that, you know, he should be remembered fondly for that. But after that, everything that transpired subsequently, it leaves a sour taste in your mouth. You know, and that second contract that he received from them, that 4 years, 110 or whatever it was, that was a disaster. And the fact that he never played, the fact that he looked like he was mailing it in, he wasn't committed, and that he suffered the, you know, wild boar injury down on the ranch down there in Florida, and that just, you know, completely threw the whole thing into chaos. Then last year when he tries to play when the team needs him, he just up and leaves the team in the middle of the, not even in the middle of the season, early in the season, because he wasn't getting the playing time that he felt he deserved. So, you know, it ended poorly, started great, but yeah, Cespedes from here on out, if I'm the Mets especially, I look down the road and see if I can find maybe somebody else, or even wait it out to see when my injured guys come back before I would ever think about re-engaging in a relationship with Yoenis Cespedes about going down that road again. That is not something you want to do. Now, Shohei Ohtani last night, you know, he was the big star, the big story going in, you know, all eyes on him. And, you know, if you're tired of Ohtani, well, don't watch the All-Star game tonight, because he's going to be the big feature again this evening. He's batting leadoff for the American League. He's pitching for the American League. So it is going to be Shohei mania again. And there's nothing wrong with that. It's great. You know, he's an exciting player, arguably the most exciting player in the game. Arguably the best player in the game, and he should be featured in a game like this, which is celebrating, you know, the best players in the sport right now. But last night, he got matched up in a duel in the first round with Juan Soto of the Washington Nationals, who, you know, we all know is a hell of a baseball player and arguably one of the best hitters in the game. You know, when he's right, I think one of the top maybe two, three hitters of the game in Juan Soto. He's that good. You know, got off to a little bit of a slow start this season, which kind of contributed to why Washington didn't get out of the gates on fire this year. But he's rounded into form, and on any given day, he can hit a bunch of balls out of the ballpark. And he ended up being the eighth seed in this tournament because they based it on the number of home runs that the guys have hit so far this season, and he doesn't have as many home runs, certainly, as some of these other guys. But he was a very dangerous number eight seed, and he gave Ohtani all that he can handle, clearly, in that first round. And it ended up going to a first tiebreaker. They were tied again after that, and then they went to a second tiebreaker. Just three swings, Soto hit all three out of the ballpark, and Ohtani rolled over one in his first swing, and so Soto ended up winning it. And Ohtani, who was, you know, the betting favorite, the prohibitive favorite, doesn't even make it out of the first round there because he gets matched up with a guy like Juan Soto. I will say this, and I look at it purely as a baseball fan, right? Somebody who follows the game, somebody who genuinely likes the game, covers the game, you name it. When I saw Ohtani and Soto going into a tiebreak situation, I just didn't think personally there was anything good that would have come from that, especially in the first round, right? I mean, if you saw Ohtani, he was gassed last night. I mean, completely gassed. He had to use that timeout in the first round, midway through his first round there, you know, how many swings in, and he was just completely shot. And that air in Denver doesn't do you any favors if you're not used to it, which I'm sure that he's not. Plus, having to go out there and swing with all your might is not easy. And some guys tend to overdo it with the adrenaline rush and, you know, a full stadium, packed house, cameras on you, all those things. And a buddy of mine today who was a former big leaguer and, you know, played the game and has taken batting practice and, you know, home runs and all that stuff, he made the point to me. He said, you know, it's a different beast during a home run derby, too, because normally when you're in any big league stadium, and you're taking batting practice, you've got the cage there. So it's a little bit of kind of a shield, right, to where it feels like it's some sort of a comforting device. You got the shield around you, the cage, to where, you know, I'm going out there, I'm doing my thing, and it feels like it's some sort of protection for me. Then you step up there, though, in the actual home run derby, and the cage is gone. It's you and a full stadium, and all eyes are on you, and you're just not trying to get a base hit, not trying to hit one, you know, between two infielders into the outfield to maybe move your runners over or score a run. No, you're trying to hit the ball as far as you possibly can, and that's nerve-wracking. You know, that takes a little bit out of you. I don't care how many times you've been in that situation before. So I think Shohei was feeling it. And then it goes into the tiebreaker, and I'm just sitting there with my fingers crossed, like, please nothing happen to these guys. Please don't let anything happen to them. I mean, like, do we really need this in the home run derby? And what baseball should do, because they're very quick to keep changing the rules and changing the formats of the derby, here's what I would do. The first tiebreaker should be the three swings. Get rid of the second tiebreaker. Alleviate more work for these guys if it ever comes to that. If these guys are tied after a round, the tiebreaker should be the three swings. One, two, three, finished, goodbye. And if each guy hits three home runs, then you do it again. You know, but don't make this, oh, here's an extra minute on the clock and see how many home runs you can hit. It does you no good. And you best believe that if you are anybody affiliated with the Nationals or anybody affiliated with the Angels and you're seeing your two prize possessions up there, you know, getting into tiebreakers in an exhibition home run hitting contest, I mean, that is the last thing, the absolute last thing you wanted to see. But thankfully, everybody came out of it okay there with the derby. And, you know, like, they put on a good show. They really and truly put on a good show. I mean, I know that it takes, you know, a while to get it over with, and, you know, it went almost 3 hours. And still, at the end of the day, is a made-for-TV production. You know, ESPN is trying to make money off of it, clearly. They pay a lot of money for the rights to air the home run derby. So there's going to be a lot of commercials. There's going to be ads. You saw that, you know, when these players took timeouts in the middle of their rounds, then all of a sudden the split screen came, and you saw an ad come onto the screen, get a 30-second commercial in there. Fine. No problem, right? It's a business. I get it. I get it. But I think if you are a fan and you just wanted a good time, you wanted some entertainment, I think you could draw a lot from what you saw last night. I enjoyed it for the most part. And, you know, the game hopefully will be even better this evening. I think that when you think about all these kind of like skillsy competitions for the different All-Star games, I would put still the Home Run Derby at the top. You know, it's better than the slam dunk contest, better than the three-point shoot. Hitting a home run is a little bit more exciting than hitting a three-pointer. You know, the skills competition that they do the night before or whatever it is at the NHL All-Star game with the hardest shot and the speed skating, I mean, that's, you know, it's okay. But I still think the Home Run Derby carries some weight. I really and truly do. And, you know, it was nice that you were able to get at least some of the big home run hitters and some of the big sluggers in the game be part of the festivities there last night. It was cool to see. You know, it really and truly was. And Trey Mancini put on a good show, too. And that was nice to see. I think, you know, most people got a little bit of an introduction if they haven't already. Last night during the broadcast, they did a good job reminding everybody of what he just went through and, you know, coming back from colon cancer. And not only is he back and healthy, but he's thriving on the field. And he ended up being a finalist in this home run derby. Really, really good night for Trey and for baseball in general. You know, and let's hope that they can piggyback another one of these good nights here back-to-back with a nice All-Star game that's a well-played game. You know, you see some highlight-worthy plays from some of the best guys in the sport, and, you know, I think MLB will be satisfied too. What did you think of the Derby last night? 800-919-ESPN, 800-919-3776, and are you geeked up for the All-Star game tonight as well in any sort of capacity? You do have some local flair. We'll give you the lineups. Only one of our locals is in the starting lineup, of course. That would be Aaron Judge. He's going to back cleanup for the American League team this evening out there in Coors Field. But when we come back, we'll get to some calls. Also, the commissioner of Major League Baseball held a press conference today, and he kind of let us all in on what the thought process is for baseball about maybe changing some rules that have become unpopular for many fans over the last couple of seasons. Dan Grasso with you here on 98.7 ESPN. We're going to get into some football news involving the New York Jets coming up in about 10 minutes or so, which is pretty important for one of their key players as they get ready to head into the 2021 season. So we'll talk about that here. I found it interesting that Rob Manfred, the commissioner of the sport, had a press conference earlier today, you know, talking about the state of the game and, you know, where it's headed, what they could do better and what could change potentially. And clearly, you know, there have been different avenues that baseball has explored over the last couple of seasons, fueled by the pandemic more than anything else, as we know. But a couple of them, namely the seven-inning doubleheaders and the other being extra innings starting with a runner on second base to try to speed up the game so they don't go, you know, 15, 16, 17 innings. You don't want five-hour games. And it was, you know, in an effort to get people in and out, get as many games as played as possible, having to also deal with the fact that there could be cancellations and postponements due to the pandemic, which was very much the case more so last year than it was this time around. But thankfully, and look, I wasn't a fan of them. I don't know how many of you were. But thankfully, Rob Manfred today, when he met with the media, said that in all likelihood, and remember, this is stuff that has to be collectively bargained with the players in the next CBA. And the CBA, remember, expires December the 1st. And, you know, I don't think we're headed for any sort of an easy discussion and an easy negotiation. As a matter of fact, you're probably looking at some sort of a work stoppage, and I would not be shocked in any way, shape, or form if, you know, and it pains for me to say it, but, you know, next season might be delayed. You know, there probably will be some work stoppage just because these two sides, we know, do not like each other. They don't see eye to eye, and they don't agree on very much right now. But seven-inning doubleheaders, runner on second base and extra innings, baseball's aim is to do away with those completely. You know, to make them a thing in the past, as if they never even happened before. And I'm in full agreement on that. You know, the sooner that happens, the better. I know the game moves a little bit faster. I get it with the runner on second base, but to me, that's not baseball, right? It's too gimmicky. And I think that sometimes, and especially a sport like baseball, they get caught up in a lot of that stuff. You know, whenever they want to make some of these changes to improve the game, speed up the game, add this to the game, you know, the more and more you tinker with something, and it's not just baseball in this sense, it could be any sport, the more and more that you tinker with something, I always say it then ceases to become more and more or less and less of what that game used to be. So if you want to keep adding on and adding new things to baseball, it's like you might as well call it a different game. You know, if we're just continually making all these changes over the next, you know, 10, 15 years, like, what is it going to look like then? You know, what's the game going to look like in another 20 years if we keep having all these different, like, hokey things to it? So I'm so glad that those two appear to be a thing of the past here starting next season. Hopefully, players have to agree to it. The other one, which has gotten a lot of conversation, of course, involves the shift. Rob Manfred said his intention is to propose doing away with the shift or putting some regulations in. Already what they're doing in the minor leagues to where the infielders, you know, they have to have 2 feet on the dirt. Can't be on the grass. You know, two guys on the right of second base, two guys on the left of second base. And you could say that players have been shifting for a lot of years, and it has, but maybe it hasn't caught on and become the phenomenon that it's been for the last several seasons. But that's one of the contributing factors as to why people feel that the game is growing a little bit stale and it's not as interesting as it once was. You know, why isn't it as popular as maybe it was decades ago, right? It was the national pastime. It's not the national pastime anymore. It's not. You know, more balls need to be put in play. And one of the things that's standing in the way of that happening on a day-in, day-out basis is clearly the shift. You know, when you see a ball hit off a guy's bat and you think that it's going to find some pay dirt, and it's a base hit, and then all of a sudden it's hit to the shortstop who's playing in essentially shallow right field on a one-hopper, takes some of the drama away. You know, takes a guy off the bases. There was a poll conducted. And, you know, they just wondered to fans, you know, what to you are the most exciting aspects of a baseball game. You may feel differently. You may have your personal favorites. I have my personal favorites, whatever. But they said the three most exciting things that happen in a baseball game, in no particular order, a double, a triple, and a stolen base. Okay. Well, that involves the speed game, the running game, which can be a big part of the game. I know that stolen bases are few and far between now. Certainly not what they used to be. You know, the days of guys stealing 100 bases, you may never see it again. But the running game does bring an element to baseball, which is exciting. You know, guy trying to steal second, guy trying to, you know, maybe swipe third. You know, that changes the complexion of a baseball game. Getting in scoring position, that type of stuff. Guy trying to leg out a double, stretch one into two. You know, here comes the throw from the outfield. Is he going to beat it? Yes, no. You know, whether you approve, whether you disapprove, depending on what the play is. If you like it, you stand up, you cheer, right? It's excitement. Same thing with a triple. You know, that doesn't happen every day, of course. But it's exciting. Keeps fans engaged. Those things don't take place when you have the shift. And when you have the fielders in such perfect position to be able to track down every single ball that's hit. You know, and if I'm part of the Players Association, this is just me. A lot of these guys are hitters, of course, unless you're a pitcher. You know, we're not going to see pitchers hit next year in all probability, so that's going to be gone. But if I'm a hitter, yeah, you know what? I'd love to be able to have an opportunity to get some more hits, to improve my batting average. You know, if I feel I make good contact, then all of a sudden it's just, like I said, right in the glove of one of these fielders because they're in the right place, right time. How does that benefit me? Now, on the flip side, if I'm in the field and I got my glove and I'm going to go where my manager tells me to go, where the trends and where the analytics tell me that I should be positioned, well, all right, it might help me on that end, but offensively, that's really where you get paid more than anything else. Right? You're trying to make a living. You're trying to cash in and maximize your earning potential. Guys get paid more for their bat than they do their glove. That's no secret. Right? You want to hit. That's how you change games. That's how you make a name for yourself more often than not. Being productive with the bat. So I think the players probably are tired of that a little bit. I know that fans are. I've spoken to tons of them. Tons of them. They don't want to see the shift anymore. Move on from it. And remember, a couple of weeks ago, on the 4th of July of all days, when the Yankees and Mets staged that split game, split admission, seven-inning doubleheader, I mean, that was robbery. That was robbery to the fans. Nobody should be paying full price for a ticket for a game that's only seven innings and not the full nine. Especially when you paid thinking you were going to see a full a nine-inning game, and then only to have some postponement and an adjustment in the schedule, go ahead and have to change that around, and then you lose out on a couple of innings. But you don't get that discount back at the box office. You don't get to go to the box office when you leave the stadium and say, hey, you know what? Today's game was only seven innings. Can I get 20% of what I paid for this ticket back? They're going to laugh at you. Right? Unfortunately, you don't get that type of a receipt when it's all said and done. You just don't. But hopefully, if the commissioner's words mean anything and they carry any weight and both sides can come to this agreement, maybe the game will get back to a place that maybe we're a little bit more familiar with it going into the 2022 season. When we come back, Jets are running out the clock with one of their key players, and it might not be a good thing. We're taking it for another 60 minutes, right up until we send it out to Coors Field All-Star Game 2021. Missed it last year, but now it's back. Should be a fun one out there, too, between the AL and the NL squad. But we'll get to the baseball stuff coming up in a little bit. And don't forget, you can always get me on Twitter, at Dan Graca, G-R-A-C-A. Want to actually talk some football. Why? Well, because a report came out earlier today from Ian Rappaport of the NFL Network. And some of you may know, some of you may not know, that the deadline for players that were given the franchise tag by their respective teams to be able to sign a long-term multi-year contract with that club is now just a couple of days away. Actually, we're less than 48 hours away from that deadline. Thursday, 4 o'clock Eastern, is when the New York Jets, and in this case we're talking about Marcus May, their safety, who they gave the franchise tag to, they have until Thursday afternoon to be able to work out a multi-year contract. If they don't, well, don't worry, Marcus May will still be a Jet this year, but he might not be a Jet much longer after 2021. He'll play under the franchise tag at $10.6 million. That's what the tender is, which is good money. Right? All things considered, I mean, my God, any of us would sign right now for $10 million to play football for 1 year. But if you're a professional athlete and if you feel you are worthy of being compensated as one of the better players at your position, which, you know, clearly Marcus does. And, you know, Marcus is a favorite of mine. Big Marcus May guy. on the field, off the field, one of the best dudes in that locker room that I have the opportunity to interact with, you know, doing the Jet stuff that I do, of course. If he signs that tender for $10.6 million, there are going to be eight safeties in the NFL this year. Eight that are due to make more money than even that franchise tag tender on their AAV, average annual value. So he would only be like the, you know, barely a top 10 paid safety in the National Football League. Marcus May fashions himself to be a lot better than that. And you know what? At times he plays like it. He does. So according to this report from Ian Rappaport, Marcus May and his representatives made a proposal to the Jets. This was a few weeks back. The Jets have not responded, according to the report. And the offer that the May camp put towards the Jets, they pulled off the table. He went on to say that the offer that the Jets made to Marcus May, the average annual value of what the Jets proposed, was 20% less than what Marcus May would be getting on the franchise tender this year, which is $10.6 million. So 20% less of $10 million. So somewhere probably in that $8 million range. Now, you know, if Marcus May didn't get slapped with the franchise tag by the Jets, and if he was free to walk and was able to just go talk to other teams and sign with wherever he wanted to this past offseason, according to reports, he had offers and he had conversations, or teams had conversations with his agent, even higher than what the Jets were offering. So that's what he's looking at and saying, you know, I want to get paid. You know, where is mine? And especially a professional football player, when the average career is, what, 3-4 years, if that, and I'm being generous, you know, you only have an X amount of years to where you can cash in. And football is, you know, as bottom line of business, as cutthroat of business as maybe any of the professional sports, especially when you're not talking about guaranteed money and to where they can cut you at a moment's notice and they want to save a couple of bucks on, you know, the contract. And, you know, so whatever, whenever you see these crazy contracts in the NFL, like this guy signs, you know, 4 years, $85 million. Well, it's not all $85 million. Then they always tell you what the guaranteed money is. That's the money that they're due to take home, that they're promised to take home. It is a rarity that a guy is going to see every last cent of what they signed for on that contract. So, yeah, if I'm Marcus May, I'd want to get paid as well. You know, and there's a lot of players, not just him, there's a lot of players who kind of feel insulted in a way by the franchise tag. And that it's not necessarily, you know, a sign of good things to come between the player and the actual team themselves. And look, I don't have to tell you about Marcus May and what he brings to this team. He's an extremely versatile safety. Okay, you can play him deep as that roaming center fielder, if you will. You can play him down in the box to where he's going to, you know, be involved in the contact a little bit more and be a little bit more disruptive in the backfield. You saw that on a couple of occasions, you know, this past year. The Jets had him in that capacity, especially early in the season. That first game against the Buffalo Bills up in Orchard Park, that's what he did. And he put up a lot of very productive numbers that day. And I thought he handled the situation well because they were trying to see if he was going to be somebody to fill in for what Jamal Adams capable, or, you know, more often than not did during his time there. You know, Adams was a box safety. May was back deep, and that's how they complemented each other nicely. But, you know, they had May doing both things for this club last year, just trying to see how the rest of the guys in the defense, specifically the secondary, were going to be able to play off of him. And you look at the Jets and the defense as a whole going into this season. The secondary is one area that if you had to say, yeah, I'm a little concerned about this department going into the season, it would be the secondary, because it is a very young, very inexperienced group for the most part. And May is the one who has the most tenure and the guy who has the most experience back there. You know about the two corners and Bless Austin and Bryce Hall. These are third-year and second-year players, right? They lack experience. Now you're handing the keys to that defense to those two guys. Guys who have not exhibited that they can stay healthy and be productive from start to finish for a full 16-game season. And now you're going to ask each of those guys to be out on an island with potential game breakers and game-changing wide receivers. That's a lot to ask, right? You look at the safety position. You know, Ashton Davis was a guy who was drafted that the Jets thought he could be like a Swiss Army knife and a jack of all trades and move him all around the field. But he's coming off of an injury, of course. That slowed his offseason program, especially now. Remember, you got a new coaching staff, new defense. And Ashton Davis hasn't exactly been able to get those on-field reps in Robert Saleh's scheme. You know, he's been doing a lot of the classroom work and in meetings and that sort of stuff, but not on the field. When he was at, you know, when I was at minicamp and OTAs, he was on the field in sweats. He didn't have a helmet. He wasn't running around. He was just standing off to the sidelines observing more than anything else. So much so that the Jets went out and signed LaMarcus Joyner, a free agent safety in the offseason. He's more of a veteran. They've got big plans for him. They think that he's going to be able to be a valuable player in that back four for them. And then you have Marcus. And, you know, he's the leader of that group. He's the captain of the secondary. He's one of the captains of this team. He's one of the leaders of this team. So his presence is valuable, as I keep saying. But why this doesn't necessarily resonate all that well to me is that, yeah, Marcus is a guy who they drafted, right? Second-round pick, same year as Jamal Adams. Remember, they took the two safeties in the first and second round, Jamal in the first and Marcus May in the second. Yeah, it was Mike Maccagnan who made the pick, the prior regime. It doesn't matter, you know, because the one thing that the Jets have been guilty of here over the last several years, and they'll even acknowledge it. And again, maybe a lot of the sins were from the previous administration, but there's no other way around it. They have a hard time keeping their own guys in the program past their rookie contracts. And there's various factors that contribute to that. Number one, sometimes the player makes the decision easier because he proves that he's not worth it, i.e., you know, the Darren Lees of the world, who was a first-round pick, and they traded him away because he wasn't producing on the field. You know, sometimes it just doesn't work out. It's a bad pick. But then you have other cases where they're unable to come to an agreement on the numbers. Things don't work out, you know, and then they end up having to trade these players before they even get an opportunity to sign a second contract with the New York Jets. You know, Jamal Adams kind of, you know, mouthed his way out of town. I think that he's as much to blame as the team is there. Leonard Williams, you know, they traded him away. He was coming up on a contract. It was the midpoint of the season. The Jets were going nowhere. You know, Leonard Williams' numbers weren't eye-popping that season. Jets moved him to the Giants. Giants gave up a lot to get him. Jets thought it was good value. And I think it was. And good for Leonard that now he got his money and he's producing as a member of the Giants, and hopefully it's a better scheme fit for him. But those are just a few of the examples. You know, Sam Darnold, most recently. You know, they had to trade away a guy who they thought was going to be the franchise savior after just 3 years. It's not a good look when you draft guys, especially high in the draft. You know, first couple of rounds, those guys are supposed to be foundation players for you. First round, second round draft choices, they are supposed to be imprint guys for you for years to come. You build your roster around those players. So not being able to retain them, I think, is a blight on the organization. And I'll tell you something else. It's certainly 100% something that players and agents across the sport also take notice of. Because free agents, when they, you know, are trying to think of what their next destination is going to be and where they might sign and where they'd like to call home and maybe where they'd like to go play, even if the Jets have a lot of money and they come calling, or maybe if it's not exactly an offer that they can't refuse and it's between the Jets and some other team, let's say, you know, they're going to think back to like, well, you know, word on the street is they don't necessarily take care of their own very well there, right? They draft guys and then they let them go. They don't keep them around. So is that really an environment and is that really a program that I want to be part of? And some people may balk to that. It's their right. Well, that's why I said it has long-reaching effects the more and more you're unable to retain and unable to sign your own draft choices. And for the most part, these are good players. You know, and my gosh, if you want to blend the on-the-field and the off-the-field, you're not going to find a better combo than Marcus May. Guy is a rock-solid human being. You know, he is a leader in that locker room. Doesn't speak a lot. Not a boisterous guy. You know, he's the polar opposite of what Jamal Adams was in terms of personality and that sort of thing, and that's fine. You know what? He leads by example, but he leads. And the guys in that room respect him. And I would hate to say, or hate to see the day that the Jets would be unable to keep a guy like Marcus May around for at least another multi-year contract in the green and white. So Thursday, 4 p.m., unless things dramatically change here over the next 48 hours, it looks like no long-term deal, and Marcus May is going to have to settle for the franchise tag, which might be a precursor to his last season as a member of the Jets. We'll be back with you tomorrow, same time as a matter of fact, at 6:30, right after the K Show, and we'll take you an extra hour up until 9 o'clock, and then we will hand it over to Game 4 of the NBA Finals between the Suns and the Milwaukee Bucks, and we'll see if the Bucks can rise to the occasion again on their home floor and make this a 2-2 series. And you know what? Let's hope they do, you know, unless you're a Phoenix Suns fan, of course. But, you know, if you're just a casual fan, you want to see a nice, long, competitive NBA Finals, then you root for the Bucks tomorrow. Make this 2-2, make it a best 2 out of 3, and, you know, we'll go from there. Speaking of basketball, I don't know if you guys saw this, and for the record, let the record show, I did not watch a second of it. Didn't watch a second of either one. Not a single bounce of the ball. When Team USA, which is gearing up, of course, for the Olympic Games, which get underway very shortly over in Tokyo, they played a couple of exhibition games, one against Nigeria a few days ago, yesterday against Australia, and they lost both of them. Now, since USA Basketball started using professional players in 1992 with the Dream Team, of course, the single greatest basketball team ever assembled, in exhibition games since 1992, so we're talking about almost 30 years, they're 54-2, okay, before these last two losses that they suffered, 54-2. And now you lose back-to-back exhibition games, Nigeria and Australia. You hear all about the team chemistry, oh, these guys haven't played with each other. You're the best players in the world. I know that the gap is narrowed substantially from what it once was with some of these other countries. And look, some of these other countries, of course, have NBA players on them. Australia last night had Patty Mills, Joe Ingles. No Ben Simmons, though. Ben Simmons is still deciding whether or not he, you know, he's going to take a shot. You know, he's working on his skills. He decided not to go play for Australia, even though Team Australia and Australian basketball was counting on him in a major way, and he kind of left them hanging. So, Greg Popovich, the head coach, after the game last night, doing the press conference, meeting with the media, he was sitting alongside Damian Lillard, one of the players on the team. And Joe Vardan, who does a good job covering basketball for The Athletic, asks him a question about the team's struggles of late here and tries to relate it to maybe years past of USA Basketball and how they fared along the way. And then things kind of went awry slightly. Take a listen.
I mean, I know that Coach has been preaching this about how much better the rest of the world has gotten over the years. But in this being your first Team USA experience in the Olympics, that sort of thing, what's it like for you to have watched your colleagues go through some of these tournaments and blow these teams out? And now you are kind of experiencing a much different, much closer, tougher experience.
Let me also answer that question. You know, you asked the same sort of question, the same family of question last time, where you assume things that are not true. When you just mentioned, you know, blowing these teams out, that's never happened. So I don't know where you get that. So, can I finish my statement? Can I finish my statement? When you talk... Are you going to let me finish my statement or not? So you'll be quiet now while I talk, and then I'll listen to you. When you make statements about, in the past, just blowing out these other teams, number one, you give no respect to the other teams. And I talked to you last time about the same thing. We've had very close games against 4 or 5 countries in all these tournaments. So the good teams do not get blown out. There are certain games that might happen in one of the tournaments, in the World Championship, the Olympics, where somebody gets blown out. But in general, nobody's blowing anybody out for the good teams. So when you make a statement like that, it's like you assume that's what's going on. And that's incorrect.
All right. lot to unpack there. First of all, you got like bully Popovich there. That's Popovich's thing. You know, he tries to bully people in the media. It's an act that's grown tired over the years. And, you know, when the wins and the championships and the titles start drying up, which they may be already for San Antonio, you know, it's going to be tolerated less and less and less. You know, he does it. Everybody thinks it's funny when he does it with the sideline reporters during the games when he only gives them a one-word answer and so on and so forth. But, you know, Popovich doesn't look like as much of a genius lately, does he? When Tim Duncan is off in the retirement home and Tony Parker and Manu Ginobili and Kawhi Leonard, when he doesn't have those guys anymore, it's funny. We're advertising the NBA Finals tomorrow. I didn't see the Spurs name on the schedule, right? I didn't see the Spurs name in the playoffs this year. Did you? Maybe I missed it. So that's number one. Number two, he is a basketball coach. And there is competition here. And specifically as it pertains to the game against Nigeria that he's calling to mind, and even Australia. A couple of things. He's not going to sit there, you know, he's trying to pay and give credit to those other teams. Australia has Patty Mills. He and Patty Mills, of course, have a relationship, player coach for how many years with the Spurs, okay? Nigeria, the head coach of Nigeria is Mike Brown, right? Former head coach in the NBA, and oh, by the way, a former Popovich assistant with the San Antonio Spurs. So he and Mike Brown are close. If Popovich goes on there and says, yeah, you know what? It's embarrassing that we lost to Nigeria. It's embarrassing that we lost to Australia. Well, then he's undermining his friends, the guys that he has relationships with. And he's not going to do that. Like, if he says, geez, I can't believe we lost to that crappy Nigeria team, then he's going to make Mike Brown look like a fool as the coach. Like, oh, we have no business losing to these guys, which, in theory, they probably don't. Now, in terms of accuracy, he was trying to talk over Joe Vardin and telling him that, no, in recent years, Team USA was not blowing out these other teams. Well, I did some homework for the show. And Joe Vardin's right. Popovich is wrong. 2016, last time we had the Olympics, Team USA, which United States won gold, okay? First game against China, USA won by 57. Does that sound like a blowout to you? Next game against Venezuela, USA won by 44. Does that sound like a blowout to you? Now, next game against Australia, it was only a 10-point game, but still, double-digit win. Next game, even tighter against Serbia, 3 points. France, another 3-point affair. Okay, so you have a few close ones. Then against Argentina in the quarterfinals, 27-point victory. They played Spain in the semis. That was only a 6-point win. And then the gold medal game, they beat Serbia. You know how much they beat Serbia by in the gold medal game? And this is really the heart of my point about pressing the panic button over these exhibition games. They beat Serbia by 30 for the gold medal. Earlier in the tournament, they only beat Serbia by 3. So what does that tell you? When it mattered the most, when the stakes were at its highest, when it was gold or silver as the only two possibilities, they stepped up their game. And they were 30 points better, and it was a rout. So Popovich, maybe we'll give him, you know, a copy of the scores so he can go back and look. I know that Coach K was still the head coach of that team. You know, Greg wasn't the one who was calling the shots necessarily. But they were a lot of lopsided wins in there. There were a lot of lopsided wins. And if we do a little fun math, the average margin of victory for Team USA during the 2016 Olympics was 22.5 points. You know what? I think any coach would sign up for that, winning a game by an average of 22 points. Now, should we push the panic button? Like, is this like major news? The fact that, you know, we lost back-to-back exhibition games against two inferior basketball teams. And with everything that I just got done telling you, the answer is no. You know what I mean? Like, the answer is no. And as we're speaking right now, Team USA seems to be righting itself, and they're taking it all out on Argentina. They're beating Argentina by 22 points with 6 minutes left in the game. So all is right with the world. Now, I'm not going to sit here and guarantee you that they're going to win a gold medal. I can guarantee you that they should win a gold medal. But these are exhibition games. Relax. You know, we can have this conversation again in another couple of weeks if they don't win gold. But I'm going to go out on a limb and say that they probably will, because after all, even though it's not our, I don't know, how many guys are on the team? 12, 15? Even though it's not our 12 or 15 true best players from the NBA, still a lot of good ones on there. All right, any team that has Kevin Durant and Damian Lillard on it for starters, I will take them to win any competition. I don't care what it is. Even if it's a hot dog eating contest, I will take them to win it, because they're going to be the best players on the floor regardless. 800-919-ESPN, 800-919-3776. So I like, you know, trying to drum up some attention for these exhibition games. Maybe it's drumming up attention here for even the Olympics in general. I don't know what it is, but I don't think there's any cause for worry right now when you're talking about Team USA. Let's say hi to Lee in Long Island. He's going to be up next here on 98.7. Lee, how are you?
What's up, Dan? Nice to talk to you.
What's up, Lee? What's going on?
I wanted to ask about the officiating in these games. I know they're officials from the FIBA. They're not NBA officials. So these players are not getting these, you know, these little, I call them the Trae Young fouls. You know, when
right.
you, like, run into a defender and you, they're not getting none of those calls. I've seen at least four, five, six plays, and I've seen the players, like Damian Lillard, getting frustrated. So I want to see if that's going to affect their play in any type of way. So I want to get your thought on that.
Yeah,
I'm gonna hang
I
up
mean,
and
I,
listen to you. Thanks for
yeah,
taking my
Lee,
call.
Thanks for the phone call. I don't know, to be honest with you, if it has anything exclusively to do with the officiating. I'll say, because, again, I told you I didn't watch the games. I'm not going to sit there and watch exhibition, you know, FIBA basketball games. But I don't think these games should be coming down to a possession here, a possession there, a missed call here, a ticky-tack foul there, right? They're the better team. They're the ones that should be winning the game regardless. That's how I look at it. So I don't think the officiating necessarily should play that big of a role in everything that's going on here. Let's say hi to Scott in Ridgewood. He's up next here on 98.7 ESPN. Scotty, how are you?
Hey, Dan, I'm doing great. Thank you. Thanks for taking my call. I wanted to talk a little bit about about baseball and some of your points. I know that was a little earlier in your discussion,
right.
But you know, a couple things you were hitting on. One is the shift, and, you know, Manfred's potential to change the shift. And the other was good fans like speed in baseball. And I think, you know, as a Yankee fan as well, I think we're all kind of frustrated with you know, guys swinging for the fences, and we'd love to see some small ball. And so to me, it feels like the shift is something. And I agree that baseball needs to make adjustments. But with that, the question is it the rules that need to adjust, or the players need to adjust with the coaches? And it's just, you know, that there's ways to beat the shift, and it just requires bunting. It requires slapping a ball down the third baseline. You know, Ted Williams, they called it the Ted Williams shift, you know, hit 400 with the shift on. And, you know, it can be done. And I feel like the guys who are likely to be able to bunt are also the guys who have speed on the bases. And that's something that, you know, coaches and, you know, general manager could bring back to help beat the shift. And I wanted to see your thoughts.
I mean, you're not wrong, because that has been a solution and a possible, you know, suggestion for, you know, the last several years since this became more prevalent, certainly in baseball. But is that exciting? Like, for instance, you got a left-handed batter up at the plate, right? And he's in the batter's box, and they're going to shift him to the right side of the infield because a pole hitter doesn't like to go the other way with the ball. So they bring the third baseman over to, you know, the right side of the infield. They'll keep the shorts up there. So, like, the whole third base area is completely vacant. Completely.
Right?
Yeah. And so all you got to do, as you said, slap the ball that way, and then you're going to have an easy base hit, or drop down a bunt, whichever you choose. But if we're talking about generating more excitement back into the game, which is really like the thesis behind trying to minimize the shift, is that really all that exciting, Scott? Just seeing a guy drop a bunt down the third baseline when there's nobody there and the best he's going to get is a single? Like, bunts are not exciting. I'm sorry. You know what I mean?
No, I understand. And I kind of agree with you. But so here's a kind of another kind of counterpoint. Think about it from a basketball perspective. If you can't hit the three-point shot, it's going to be really tough to penetrate from a defensive perspective. And so the defense plays soft. In baseball, we're looking for more offense. The defenses play really soft because they know nobody's going to bunt. And so if you, you know, if you keep them guessing, if you're bunting, if you're stealing, you are going to make the defense, I think, open up a little bit for more offenses. It's just another point.
Yeah, I mean, again, it's possible, but I like the fact that baseball is going to, you know, go ahead and try to change this whole thing up here, which they should. You know, and some of these things need to be eliminated. And one of the things they could start with, too, you know, that, and Scott, thanks for the phone call. One of the things that, you know, certainly they can look to also add to the list of things to change is make this one-year experiment with these All-Star games literally just that, a one-year experiment. These things are awful as they're doing the player introductions right now as I'm looking at it on television. They are atrocious. Zapping all individuality, zapping any identity to their teams by making everybody look exactly the same during an All-Star game, which is supposed to showcase the best and brightest talent that you have in the sport. And you completely threw that out the window with a money grab to hope that some yo-yo would go and actually buy these uniforms, which are just dreadful. They look like a company softball team. There's no charm in them whatsoever.
You're listening to Chris Carlin on 98.7 ESPN.